Hello, hello. Welcome to the fifth episode of the Shropshire Witches podcast. I'm Alex and I am with the wonderful.
Amy, hello.
Hi, Amy. Hello. So this in this episode, we're going to be talking about something that is really rather difficult. And I know that Amy felt the same as me, that it was a very difficult thing to research, in that we both had some knowledge on this subject, but also it's one that we had to look into. And I think when you start reading the more personalized stories and accounts, it becomes even more difficult. So in this episode, we're talking about the workhouse, which is was a very controversial institution that ran really from the 18th century right up till, I suppose you could argue, the NHS in 1948. And it changed a lot in the 19th century, and perhaps that's when it came to its height of notoriety. So we're going to talk a little bit about that. And Amy, we're going to take it kind of, I suppose, like usual, just in turns, aren't we, in terms of where this goes. We talk about you've got a real sort of Shropshire focus on the workhouse as well, haven't you?
Yes, so I have chosen to focus on the workhouse in the Madeley Telford area. I've done that for two reasons because I think Telford is often, I've spoke about it before, but I think Telford is often very underrepresented in Shropshire discourse. I think sometimes it's often treated a little bit like Shropshire's dirty secret at times, particularly historically, when we are in the period we're looking at kind of the East Shropshire coalfield. But also because I have a link to the Madeley Workhouse in the sense that I actually, my first job was in the building, not the actual workhouse. I'm not that old.
You're younger than me
But
as well. Yeah.
my first job was in Lincoln Grange Care Home, which was in the former building of the Madeley Workhouse. So it's been a building that has lingered, I think, in my own lifetime and been quite a had quite a presence in my lifetime, even before I worked there. And I think that's allowed me to understand a little bit about how it must have impacted people growing up and living around it whilst the poor law and things like that were active.
I think that's really, really, really interesting. We'll go into that in a moment. So for context, I mean, I thought, look, the workhouse is so, I don't like the word famous, infamous, to us all, even today. And obviously you have that connection as well, which is extraordinary. We'll go into that. But I thought, well, look, we'll open with a quote. And of course, given the time of year, and also one of the most famous novelists who really brought forward the plight of the poor and the workhouses, of course. And I mean, really, we should be getting a cut for how often this guy gets mentioned in our podcast, but is Dickens. Where in A Christmas Carol, when Scrooge is approached to give money to charity, the gentleman seeking money for the charity says, "Hundreds of thousands are in want of common comfort, sir." And Scrooge famously says, "Are there no prisons?" And the gentleman replies, "Plenty of prisons," said the gentleman, laying down the pen again. "And the union workhouses?" demanded Scrooge. "Are they still in operation?" "They are still," returned the gentleman. "I wish I could say they were not." "The treadmill and the poor law are in full vigour then," said Scrooge. "Both very busy, sir." "Ah, I was afraid, from what you said at first, that something had occurred to stop them in their final course, in their useful course, sorry," said Scrooge. "I'm very glad to hear it." See, that in itself, we know that changes by the end, but this idea that even in the 19th century, workhouses, the infamy that they carried, and that Dickens knew well, that the caricature of somebody who was pro them as an institution and thinking that they benefited the poor was already in the 19th century, although at the height of their operation, was already sort of befitting of a certain type of person that maybe wasn't renowned for their benevolence. So if we go into the actual poor law itself, now I'm not going to go into huge detail with these because I think what's important with the workhouse, and I think you probably feel like this, Amy, as well, is that yes, I think the politics is important and the origins of it, but I think actually looking at the fact that these people were real people and their anecdotes and even looking at these buildings and what they were designed to try and achieve or the fear that they ignited, I think those are the attributes to me that are worth discussion
Oh,
more
definitely.
than in, the in Parliament, in the House of Lords, and all these people that really were so far removed from anything like this that it'll just end up making us angry. So the 1601 Poor Law was the Elizabethan was probably really the first kind of like consolidated legislation for this, and this was used to distinguish between what they called the impotent poor and the idle poor. Now, there was this long-standing belief in terms of the poor that were deserved in that could work. Perhaps something had befallen them, and then you'd got those that just refused to work. And I think, sadly, we still have that trope today with people like Nigel Farage fear-mongering and making out that everybody on the street that maybe is begging actually has a home and a life, and they're professional beggars and all this kind of absolute nonsense. This was overhauled in 1834. Which established a system of relief, which was then put into parishes under poor law unions. So prior to that, really what would happen is there were almshouses, and there's lots of still remaining, and often, more often than not now, they're actually just private dwellings. But there's almshouses in Bishop's Castle, in Ludlow, in Stratford-upon-Avon. There's lots of places, York, you can go to and see what now look like really rather quaint little sort of pretty houses that were almshouses that you could go and visit, go and stay in for a while, maybe if you weren't well. And they were more of a kind of cottage industry, really. After a number of different things that you say, when you had the agricultural revolution going into the industrial revolution, even that's a little bit further along, the Napoleonic Wars, there were lots of continued casualties and vast numbers of people that had been injured by social issues, let's say, and were left in need. And this was ever on the increase, that really a kind of an early 17th century law no longer fitted. And so it needed an overhaul. Workhouses, as we would recognise them, maybe architecturally, they did change in the 19th century, but started to come into being really in the 1700s and were called workhouses then as well. In fact, actually, there's some in the 17th century referred to by that name, where really people did go to perform tasks and then were paid. But this idea of alms, really what started to happen was that they would come up with guardians, which we'll go more into, made up of different people from different parishes who were all on a board. And in essence, they would sort of be in charge of the workhouses, of employing people to work at the workhouse. People going into the workhouse would go and approach this board of guardians, and they would see whether they could give them alms, which is sort of a little bit of money to tide them over. So if they were a seasonal employment, like, if they were hot pickers, things like this, or whether they felt they were actually a worthy cause for going into the workhouse. The whole premise of the workhouse, really, as was a long-standing and really in some ways still today, unfortunately, was the sort of the view of punishment of poverty, was that it was supposed to be really the sort of the last resort. So you really only went there if you had to. They didn't want people to go there to get an easy ride. These are not my views, by the way. This is how they felt. And so the idea was that really it was almost paramount to prison in terms of bare cells in which they slept. The food was minimal, the treatment was harsh, they gave them mind-numbing menial tasks to complete, all these things that really just kept them off the street. But the view was that in some respects you were being punished, but in another way it was supposed to just be basically a way of keeping you off the street. It was the last resort. So we'll go more into kind of the group parishes and things like this and the guardians as we go along. But just to give you a bit of context, also architecturally, and I'll pass to you in a sec, Amy, is that the presence of these buildings was meant to intimidate. So a very good example from anyone sort of Shropshire area, Welsh border, is Fordon. That's a late, I think it's about the 1790s. That's a late 18th century workhouse. These big, formidable buildings that often were built, weren't they, on slightly elevated ground, so they sort of loom over you. And that presence and the stigma went right through to the end. And really, the generation after the workhouse still had that stigma with it. But look, Amy, let's pass to you, because you're going to tell us a little bit more about Madeley and just a bit more context and more of the kind of the emotional aspect of it as well.
Yes, I think just following on from that, it's really interesting to think about the significance of those buildings in the local community, particularly when you get to kind of the 19th kind of century, because we're not going to talk about folklore much at all, really, this episode. But I do believe the workhouse became kind of a folklore of its own. It
Yeah,
became such a
absolutely.
lingering presence in the local community that it was, well, it must have been awful. And, you know, I can't help but think of the local community, the community that hadn't really changed that much since I was growing up. When you look at the area, growing up in the presence of that building and, you know, wondering whether they were going to end up there. So I do believe, even if you didn't have really any experience or familial experience with the workhouse, the folklore of what that building could represent to you, our imagination filled in the gaps. And it really must have been a tangible fear, a really, and I think that's one thing I think both of us want to emphasize this episode is how tangible for working class people the fear of this building would have been. So I do want to look at Madeley. As I said, I grew up in Madeley. I am not that far away now where I live. And really, Madeley has always been very industrialized. Even prior to the Industrial Revolution, the area that was known as Madeley Wood. So you're looking at kind of Iron Bridge and the kind of Iron Bridge Gorge area as well as Madeley, what we call now, was very industrialized. And with that comes a level of poverty. So we know that there was elements of charity and poor law happening in Madeley from when you were saying, but around 1705, and it makes me shudder to think it, but around 1705, paupers in Madeley were being badged, which meant that they had to wear a mark of their status. And they, around 1715, were being given menial jobs to work for. So there's not a formal kind of building that they can spend time in, but they are being marked as other from around 1705 in Madeley. And there were measures to in place to take care for the poor. But there wasn't necessarily a workhouse in Madeley in that early 18th century. And you see in the kind of wider area, so for example, in 1732, Much Wenlock had kind of a workhouse of sorts. That by 1776, the Much Wenlock could house around 30 paupers. And Madeley's really comes into being around the 1760, sorry. So in 1766, the poor were being contracted out for labour and they were living in a building that we could call a workhouse. It's not quite there yet, but it's certainly got the marks of it's on the right track. The parish actually took responsibility of that building in 1780s. And between 1796 and 1797, the parish spent £1,000 on a new workhouse, which is now, if people that are listening know Madeley, it was on the road that's now Belmont, sorry, Road in Brockholes.
That's a
And
lot of money.
yeah, it's a lot of money for the time. And also Dorley and Bemthall, which are nearby, got workhouses around that time. But this building, kind of from the offset, despite the amount of money that was spent on it, wasn't really fit for purpose. And certainly as we move through its history before it moves into the new building, it was seen as lacking. The Madeley Poor Law Union came into existence on the 6th of June, 1836. So from you've got quite a bit of time where the workhouse is being looked after by the parish, but it's not really fit for purpose. And we're going to meet quite a lot of figures in the history of Madeley's workhouse, and one of them is Mr. William Day. Now, in 1834, William Day, who was a Sussex landowner, which he was very proud of sharing, was charged with implementing the Act, the Poor Law Act, in Shropshire and in Wales. But the problem with William was that he was absolutely uninterested in Shropshire. He called it sterile and he did everything he could to remind people of how unhappy he was to actually be working around poor people. So not a fan of him.
Sounds great.
He all he did, if you I was when I was reading into some of his writings at the time, all he seems to do is complain about how there are slag heaps everywhere and there are people using uncouth language and There's poor people, and he really isn't happy, and he tells everyone he's unhappy.
Nothing's changed, can I just say as well? Because if you look at the, is it the 1723? Sir Edward Knatchbull with his poor relief act, he was passed by his son, was what was described as kind of the ultra Tory. So his son was like one of the most right wing, and you're like, oh, that's great. Like, yeah, these
So,
guys
and
definitely are what the poor and those in need, definitely. Like, you've got the right guys for the job.
yeah, you definitely pick the right fellow. But weirdly, with
That's it.
Day, he has a horrible attitude about Telford and what we now call Telford and the poor of Madeley. So he's got a horrible attitude of the people he's actually been given the job to support. But when you look at his actual theories about the workhouse and you look at his kind of priorities about the workhouse, really, he's quite, I mean, it's still awful because it's a workhouse, but he's quite forward thinking. So he did believe that you should have specific specialist institutions for different classes of pauper. So, for example, he advocated for separate schools and facilities. So he wanted pauper children to get an education. I hate using that phrase, pauper children, but it's the phrase from the time, not what I would call
I was
now.
going to say that's probably a good point to make. Is times like that that I know both are probably going to mention are of their time. They're not how we feel. And I think when you're talking about something like this, that's yeah, you're absolutely right to say that these are not words that we would use or in any way agree with. It's terms that were recognised at that point. So I think it's really, yeah, it's really key you mentioned that.
And he did. So he thought that people who were in the workhouse should get an education. And he did believe that there should be separate facilities for people who were suffering from mental illnesses. So repote isn't a word. He wrote a report for the Poor Law Commissioners on the 20th of January, 1838. And he wrote about a lot of the Shropshire unions and the different state of the workhouses. But he said, particularly with regard to Madeley, that there was still room for a lot of improvement, particularly in the education of children, because that just wasn't happening. And for the treatment of people with mental illnesses, they would allow people who had maybe long-standing mental problems, mental they were suffering to be in the same facilities as people who were just poor, and that would cause greater kind of upset for both parties. And he basically said that the Poor Law Union and the way that it was being run in Madeley was not fit for purpose. And I think when you think about this kind of situation, and you'll see it a lot when we look through this episode, is that these are very rich men whose job it is to determine what's fit for purpose and how they can cut corners and make things more financially viable and all that kind of thing. But at the heart of it, there are people who are living in substandard conditions. Madeley has always been poor. It's always had a class of people who were better off, but it's always had an issue with poverty. So to be so poor that you end up in a workhouse is particularly kind of remarkable for this area, but I think for also areas elsewhere in Britain, how desperate you must have felt to be walking through those doors, not knowing you're going to come back out or whether you're going to come back out,
I
and you're
think,
going to somewhere that is deemed not fit for purpose.
yeah, I totally agree, and I think it's like you mentioned the pauper badges, which just in itself is, like famously in the workhouses, which, by the way, wasn't every workhouse, but they did make, in some instances, unmarried mothers wear yellow. I think that was probably slightly exaggerated in terms of how prolific that was, but even if it happened in one place, that's one place too many. But it did happen. The pauper badge, as you say, so the P, and the fact that also you would then equally wear maybe the other letter for the parish that you were in. I find it all abhorrent. And I think what the other thing that is, and look, you want to say interesting, but maybe that's not the most sort of appropriate word, but man's kind of proclivity for cruelty, it never ceases to surprise, but also for hierarchy, because even within those situations with the destitute, that were stripped of any kind of, through no fault of their own, any sort of dignity formed their own hierarchy. And I don't say that in a patronizing way. I say that in the sense of that man's kind of necessity to feel either included or above somebody else, or to you know, in many ways, quite rightly, try and have this kind of sense of dignity, but often sadly, as is common with mankind, at the expense of somebody else. Because, you know, as is quoted, it says the treatment of vagrants varied, but generally they were deemed lower class citizens and subjected to harsher treatment than the deserving poor. So if you were talking about Madeley already, how these people were treated, which is, you know, we go into, and I've got some recipes and things and some punishments I can read to you later on, but it was abhorrent. But this idea that you would have, people visiting that were homeless, even in that instance of going in, were treated hideously, you know, and they were allowed to stay maybe one day in 30. And I think by the 1880s, it changed slightly and you could stay for two nights. But prior to that, you know, you had people called, I mean, look, this is not foreign to either of us, but this idea of social explorers. And, you know, look, one thing, and I think you'll find this interesting, was a journalist called James Greenwood, who, and I think it was about 1888, something like that, I think, round about then, 1866, sorry, I got that wrong, so 1866. He wrote A Night in a Workhouse, and he was a journalist that basically for the Pall Mall Gazette, and he went in anonymously, like you would have kind of, you know, those secret shoppers, and you think, God almighty, like it's, I can see what he's trying to achieve, but also it feels slightly entitled because some of his descriptions of what happened when he was in there, you know, he uses very kind of verbose, and he was saying one of these characters was fit for a Dickens and things like this. And he talks about one man, which I really struggle to read, how one man, he said, he had still had his dignity, was in tears when he was picking oakum, you know, when they're picking apart oakum, for context, is these, when they picked apart these old ropes that had tar and things on them, they picked them apart because they the shipping industry would buy them to sort of bung holes and various things. But it was really difficult work. And they had people that they could tell by their hands, obviously, how whether they were kind of clean and new to this or not. But they would give them a certain amount per day that they had to do. And this was usually the job of either women or those maybe not fit enough to sort of break rocks and things like that. And again, we can go into some of the jobs a little bit later on. But you've got to ask yourself the questions like you're doing. These are generally considered fit for purpose. What on earth are the places that aren't fit for purpose offering? And I've got to add, if I can, just quickly, that there was Andover Workhouse famously. And I think you've probably heard about this, Amy, because it is very famous. Anyone who's kind of put in any kind of interest or research into workhouses have probably come across this story. But bone crushing, which was done by, namely, vagrants, unfortunately, again, not a word that either of us would use, but they would crush animal bones for various different purposes, sometimes for fertilizer, china, things like this. But in Andover, and I know it isn't the only workhouse where this was seen, they were found that the people doing it were so hungry and desperate that they were eating rotting meat off the bones that they were crushing. And I think that is hard to hear.
And
as with all of these things we're going to discuss tonight, is that these are the realities, these happen. That I think that's in itself is another thing that is so difficult, is to remember that this happened, and really only for some people a lifetime ago, you know, because our kind of grandparents' age would have been in the shadows of the workhouse. So it's not, we haven't got the excuse of it being, you know, the 16th century or something like that. We haven't got the pea soup of time to say, oh, you know, it was the 19th century and it was the 18th century. And these are supposed to be the kind of the glory years of, you know, I hate this kind of idea of Britain and the colonies and all this nonsense. But that was the height of the empire. And look how we were treating people abroad and at home. Hideous.
Yeah, I think it is. And I think when you peel away with history, and it's the same with folklore, when you peel away the narratives and you focus it down to the person, and even if you can't comprehend the scale of people that were involved in these kind of institutions, if you just sit for a moment and imagine that one person like yourself in that situation, it's heart-wrenching. And I think for myself, and I know that you have a similar kind of background to myself, is that these buildings were weaved within our ancestors' stories.
Oh yeah, very much.
Even if our ancestors didn't end up in the workhouse, they'd have gone to bed worrying about whether they were going to end up there, particularly in certain periods of Shropshire's history. Mining went in peaks and troughs as often because it was such a epicenter for lead mining down in your area, but also in kind of my area, coal mining and other associated kind of industries. There's the idea that it would have always been like that, but particularly when kind of in the same time as the Chartist movement, Shropshire was going through a real dearth in kind of mining. There was lots of discussions around pay, and the Chartist movement did take off quite popularity in Dorley, Madeley, and also in Wellington, which is in my kind of immediate area. A lot of miners actually ended up in the workhouse due to that fighting for equality and equal rights. Also, it's interesting because there's a number of cases in Madeley where, and it's described, there's a brilliant book for people who are interested, particularly in the Madeley area, called Pitmen, Poachers and Preachers: Life in the Poor Law in the Madeley Union of Parishes, 1700 to 1930, by a wonderful local historian called Ken Jones.
We can, sorry, I
And
was going to interrupt. We can link that on our social medias as well, can't we?
yes,
Because I think
yeah.
that's going to be well worth reading, and I'll get a copy as well. But yeah, sorry, carry on.
And he describes them as the most heart-rending cases. And those were the wives and children of people whose husbands had actually either left them, or they'd gone to jail, or actually been transported. And he references three cases from the records of the Poor Law Board from the 4th of June 1846, of three women whose husbands were transported. So there was a woman called Ellen Hill, and she had her two children with her, whose husband, Job, had been convicted at Shrewsbury Prison and he'd been transported. There was a Mary Howells, and she had her three children. And also there was a woman who was called Anne Vaughan, whose husband John had been convicted over in Stafford and sent to Sydney. So you've got such a level of tragedy there. These women had not only lost their husbands, they'd lost their husbands, quite frankly, through poverty. The crimes, there's not too much details of the crimes that they'd done, but we know at least one of them, it was stealing, it was poaching, and those kind of crimes. So they've lost their husbands through poverty, and then they've ended up in the workhouse. So it's just sad. And I think for their children growing up in that kind of environment, it must have been really terrifying.
I totally agree. And I think this idea of children in the workhouse, of course, famously, perhaps in most recent times, depicted in Oliver Twist for us. I mean, look, I know that is a book that's been around a long time, but I think in terms of people growing up, maybe seeing the, is it 1968, wasn't it, when Ron Moody, Fagin and Oliver Reed and co, wherein Oliver was kind of a childhood sort of like rite of passage for all us, sort of watching that, and the Board of Guardians, and famously indulging in that meal while everyone else was starving. And of course, look, if you're going to talk about children going into the workhouse, perhaps most famously of all was Charlie Chaplin. He went in with his brother Sidney and his mother Hannah, and he went into Lambeth Workhouse, part of which actually is a museum that you can go to today, a cinema museum. But he did a really sort of interesting and actually very, very heartbreaking, which I will read if that's okay, because it's only short. But he sort of described what happened, and he recounted the story of a 14-year-old boy trying to escape, because look, people could leave the workhouse as and when they wanted, in theory. If you wanted to go out, you had to have good cause if you intended to stay. So in terms of going to a baptism or something like that. But then if you went out in your workhouse uniform, it was considered theft, then you were fined. They quite where you'd find the money for that, I don't know. But if you wanted to leave permanently, you just had to give sort of leave of absence or notice, which was generally regarded as about 3 hours. But look, for children, it was obviously a very different story. You had to have somebody that could come and collect you. And a boy of 14 trying to escape was not, rare. I believe it's a common occurrence. And he said that the climbing on the school roof and defying staff by throwing missiles and horse chestnuts at them as they claimed after him, which you sort of think is that kind of almost like something from the Beano, feels quite like kind of comical. But obviously, you remember the tragedy that's within that. And he's throwing basically not horse chestnuts because they're harmless. He's throwing horse chestnuts because that's all there is to hand, I would imagine. But for such offences, and remember this is a child and the severity. So for such offences, there were regular Friday morning punishment sessions. It's the fact they put these on a Friday and it's a punishment session just says all you need to know in the gymnasium where. And I struggle with this. We're all boys lined up on three sides of a square. For minor offences, a boy was laid face down across a desk, feet strapped. I mean, this in itself, the perversity, the bullying is hideous. While his shirt was pulled up over his head. Captain Hindram, a retired Navy man, so there you go, then gave him from 3 to 6 hefty strokes of the 4-foot cane. A grown man, a Navy man as well, so presumably a man of some strength and stature, I'd have thought. No man that does that. With a 4-foot cane, recipients would, this is the bit I hate, well, all of it I hate, but recipients would cry appallingly or even faint and afterwards had to be carried away to recover. For more serious offences, birch was used. After 3 strokes, a boy needed to be taken to surgery for treatment, and Chaplin himself once received 3 strokes of the cane, apparently for an offence he did not commit. There was a woman actually held to trial at a workhouse for what she did because children regularly had things like their heads smacked against walls. They were forced to drink from puddles, from lavatories, things like this. The bullying. The other thing, of course, was that children, because when you went into the ward, you were separated to single sex wards. And children would go into more infant wards. And then there were 7. You would go in with older boys, a lot of whom had been in the workhouse for many years. So imagine their character at that point for their own. But the amount of sexual abuse and physical abuse that went on in places like that, I mean, it is literally the survival of not even the fittest, just those that somehow through whatever means were able to survive, is awful. And schooling as well, because of course, you know, they did start to see the importance of education, but others felt that what was the point in educating paupers aside from letting them learn to read and write their own name, which I just think is, you know, I'm not going to swear in this episode out of respect, but it's effing appalling, let's say that. They would also send them to local schools in some cases, so to save money rather than having to buy equipment in schools within the workhouse. But within that, it was clearly marked that they were children from the workhouse, so local children were encouraged not to play with them or befriend them. I think the isolation and the loneliness and the cruelty. I mean, you know, Charlie Chaplin recalled having ringworm, and he, which was not uncommon amongst children in workhouses, given how they very often had to share beds and things like this. And his head was shaved and he was treated with iodine, which then obviously made him the subject of ridicule to the other boys on the wing. Their mum did come and get them, Hannah, but she suffered from mental illness and he had to get back in again. And they did come out. But they'd been left by their father, who just left. And I think out of desperation, she turned up there at Lambeth Workhouse. And he never forgot the experience and indeed did give a lot of money to the poor. And it gave him an affinity with the poor that I think kept him, even in his performances when he became so very famous that all of us still know who Charlie Chaplin is. And, you know, if you dressed up as someone, you instantly know that that's Charlie Chaplin. You know, they had this affinity with him because they felt like he was one of them. And they did go and live with their father at some point when their mother went back into an asylum. But it's this idea of children being separated from their mothers and the idea of baby farms are these far less than salubrious places that people would send their babies, in some cases paying for them, thinking that they were better off than staying with their mothers. And these people that would just sort of basically, yeah, baby farms that would take money for barely looking after children. The more you look into it, the harder it becomes. One thing I did think was interesting, and just very quickly, because I'm going on a bit here, was the euphemistic addresses, which I thought was really rather interesting. When you were born in a workhouse, and a lot of people were, that had its stigma. But in 1904, a law was changed that meant people who had been born into a workhouse could kind of, if at all possible, escape the, you know, the cloud of kind of the taboo that was around that. And they gave them these euphemistic addresses. So rather than listing Lambeth Workhouse, they would maybe list the address of Lambeth Workhouse. Or, for example, there was one in Pontefract, in Yorkshire, isn't it, Pontefract? And they would say One Paradise Garden, something like that, instead of, you know, in some cases it was the address, in some cases it wasn't, but they would list an address rather than saying Pontefract Workhouse, Ripon Workhouse, yeah, Madeley Workhouse, they'd list the address. And in 1904, that did change, with a kind of, I suppose, seen as an act of clemency. It's not really, is it, to be honest? I mean, things should have been much improved by then, but it did start to change. And the same thing was done by 1918 with death certificates. Scotland were a little bit later there in 1921, and also Scotland almost continuously referred to them as poorhouses, not workhouses. The poorhouse is a term we all know as well, but that is predominantly Scottish. And I was irritated actually for a Shropshire influence, and I wonder if you feel the same. I don't know if it's still there. I always refused to go, not in a holier than thou thing, but it really irritated me that there was a bar called the Poorhouse, which they spelt as in P-O-U-R because it was a bar, but it was obvious that they would say that play on words. And I thought, do you know what kind of arsehole are you if you're going to do a play on words on the Poorhouse? Like, prick, I'm not going there for your overpriced kind of sickly milkshakes, sod off.
No,
irritate me. Hopefully, do you know what? Yeah, hope. I don't care if they're not going anymore. Good if they're not, frankly. I shouldn't say that, but tough tits, what are you going to do?
No, I completely agree. I think there's something that you need. I think you need to be respectful when it comes to these kind of stories, because
yeah.
I think so often in history, the experiences of the poor are glossed over and they're forgotten, or they're not. There's no one historically willing to advocate for them, in so that's why it's important to do it, I think. And obviously there were people, like I'm going to mention someone in a short while that was advocating for the poor in the Union, mm-hmm. Kind of the Board of Governors, that wasn't, he was very atypical to what the Board of Governors were like. But I want to stay on the subject of children for a moment,
yeah,
and talk
do,
a little
yeah.
bit about the kind of the eight. So in 1842, there was a commission that investigated the kind of employment and conditions in mines and manufactories, we're told it's called. And that was across England, but it was particularly prevalent in Shropshire and particularly prevalent in Telford, because we'd had a number of kind of mining accidents that had involved very, very young people. The most famous in my area is the Nine Men of Madeley.
Mm-hmm.
And during this time, during this commission, they discovered that workhouse boys were actually being exploited in apprenticeships. Now, if obviously I'm on a podcast, but I'm using air quotation marks with the term apprenticeships, because it was essentially forced servitude. And these young boys were being apprenticed, again with the quotation marks, to work in coal mines for up to 12 years. Mm. And some of them were as young as 8 years old, which is incredibly exploitative on so many levels.
Yeah.
Madeley recorded several of these such cases. And in the actual commission, we are given some actual evidence from some of the boys. So, for example, I'm going to directly quote two of the boys. So we've got one called Robert North and one called Isaac Tipton. So Isaac Tipton, we're not told how old he was, but he said he went to work in the mines when he was 9 years of age, and his first job was to wait on the hollers. When their picks needed sharpening, I would go to the bottom of the shaft and send them up. When they came back down the shaft, I would return them to the hollers. I also had to collect the hollers' candles from the bottom of the shaft. After a few months, I went to work on the girdle and chain. I had a girdle round the middle and a chain under my legs. It was very hard work. The girdle often made blisters. I had little pieces like shillings on my skin, and they'd fill up with water. And when I put the girdle, the blisters would break and the girdle would stick to me. These blisters give me great pain. In all the pits, this was part. In this part, they use the girdle and chain. So it's just awful to think about how physically and mentally draining that must have been for Isaac, and how much pain he would have been in. We're also told Robert North said that he went to the pit at 7 years of age. His first job was to fill the skips at the coal face for the boys to draw away with the girdle and chain. For the first 12 months, I got 6 pence per day. This was later raised to 10 pence. When I went to work with the girdle and chain, the skin was broken and the blood ran down. I durst not say anything. If I did say anything, they, the butty and the reeve who works under them, would take a stick and beat us.
The fear.
It's just
awful.
And we're given some more insight into kind of the commissioner's findings in Madeley. And we're told that There was another boy who was called John Weaver, and he was aged 10 when he was apprenticed in February 1939 to a man known as John Bull, the charter master at Wolverhampton. And he was apprenticed until the age of 21 with no premium paid. So he was 10 and he'd been told that he wouldn't be able to leave until he was 21. You can't imagine. I don't teach 10-year-olds, but part of my job as a teacher, I teach 11 and 12-year-olds, and I can't imagine looking at them and thinking they could be trapped in such backbreaking work. And it's just hard to think about, I think. And Henry Williams, again, he was 10 and he was apprenticed in March 1840 to Henry Potts, who was a collier of Wolverhampton, and he was told that he'd be there till 21 with no premium paid. And these boys, I think one of the hardest things about it for me is these boys would have thought that this was their chance at rebuilding their future. Many of these boys were raised, either partially raised or almost their whole life had been spent in the workhouse. So this apprenticeship would have been seen as a means of bettering themselves, finding a means of employment, and being able to imagine a life outside of the workhouse. And they were given the most kind of difficult, hard, exploitative jobs. And I just can't imagine it. And I just feel really sorry for them. But I'm also grateful that this commission investigated the conditions in the mines, which didn't improve massively. Mining in the 1980s was just as dangerous and violent and difficult as it was in the 1880s or before, but it kept children to a certain extent away from these very dangerous professions. And I think it's very powerful to have their voices, to be able to hear what they said.
I think it's awful, and I just couldn't agree more. And I think it's strange. It's this jaded view, isn't it, of childhood and how we treat children, and even that kind of Tudor idea of children or adults when they're six and things. And but like, I don't understand this harking for the past, and people nowadays talk about teenagers and children and things, and I think, God, do you know what used to go on? And look, there's still so many children in this country and all over the world that are desperately in need, are in deeply unhappy family situations. And I think it is one of the great tragedies and neglect of mankind that children aren't protected to enough of a degree. They're just not. And childhood, it should be just a right of mankind that children are not treated cruelly. And tragically, it isn't. It's one of those things that just feels so abhorrent to me. And I think that it's that innocence, this idea that they're reliant on us, and the neglect and the abuse is hard to fathom and still continues, sadly. But children going to the workhouse, even if a man, able-bodied, went to the workhouse, his family had to go with him. They had no choice because such was the rule. Children under seven could be with their mothers, but then they were taken off their mothers. There were people, I thought this was interesting on reading about the workhouse when you mentioned that you worked at Madeley when it was no longer a workhouse. But there's a gentleman who's done a lot of research, a historian, he's done a lot of research into workhouses. And when he went to visit some care homes, a couple of, or a handful of which had been workhouses, which, as you'll know, with Madeley is not necessarily that uncommon. They do become hospitals and things like that. And there's some in, I think, in London where that's the case as well. Mostly they've become very, rather ironically, luxurious flats, but there you go, as have a lot of old asylums. Colney Hatch, for example. One thing I did think was very interesting was there was somebody that he met there, a resident, who had been at that care home since it was a workhouse, and had been there since about 1921. And I thought that was just devastating. They must have felt this, I don't know, but because had they become so institutionalised, they knew no different, which in itself is also just deeply, deeply tragic. I think for some statistics, not to make it a cold fact, but it's worth knowing that of course in 1834 the poor law, it was children, and look, you're a teacher and you understand as well as anyone, if not better than most, the kind of the necessity for children to be heard and feel appreciated and things like this, and to be cared for, were very underrepresented, which is not a massive surprise going on from what you're doing. And that, you know, this idea they're all separated by gender. But in 1839, half of the workhouse population, so of 97,510 people, which is a lot of people to be in work, 42,767 were children. So that's pretty cool. And I would encourage anybody, even if you just Google it, just to see the photographs. I really struggle to see it because their faces, like, these are children. Like, I just, I don't know. You just wish you could do something. And in a lot of cases, they'd never, I mean, some cases, absolutely. They had known love and they had parents that were desperate and didn't know what else to do. But lots of people, you know, they were orphans, deserted, bastards, which is a phrase I hate, I loathe. Also other horrible descriptions such as, this actually, I really struggle with this and I sort of try and compose myself just emotionally. The children of idiots or of cripples or of felons. I mean, it says that such children were not the minority. And even in 1909, the Royal Commission, half the children under the care of the Board of Guardians, which frankly, I shouldn't swear, but were a, you know, ready trove of shits, frankly, the Board of Guardians, in the 19th century, without parents or close relatives. And, you know, under the age of 16, that was it. And a lot of them were, you know, the children of people who were either dead or unfit to control them, or didn't care for whatever reason. And look, I'm not just blaming the parents, I'm blaming society, and that a lot of them were products of how they'd been brought up themselves, much as people are today. I think it's very important we emphasise at this point and any point that it is nurture over nature. If you treat people badly, if people are brought up in environments where that becomes normal. I saw once in a documentary, I thought it was really interesting, that there were some children in a community that said at first they were scared of violence. Then they grew used to it. Then they grew to enjoy it. And I think it's, there's parts of society that really we need to be focusing on helping people like that, not building luxurious hotels and things in towns that frankly have large sections of community that need a great deal of help. And I think that idea of housing all the poor, in inverted commas, in one big building, because although they deemed it a large expense at first, it was going to be cheaper to keep them in the long term. You think, keep them, for goodness sake. This idea of what do you do with the poor? What do you know, throwing money at things? I think we need, then and now, the help that's needed in society, and the level of neglect, the level of turning a blind eye, the level of blame that's put on people where it's not their fault, is same as it's ever been, I think.
Yeah. And I think that's what's so powerful about these stories and the legacy of this, is that it's not that I'm saying it could happen today, because you like to think it wouldn't, but the same prejudices that were then can still be seen across society now. And I think that's where you need people to, I think that's where we need compassion. I'm a religious studies teacher. I'm not particularly religious myself, but I think regardless of your stance or your religious perspective, the idea of compassion and unconditional love, in Christianity it's called agape love, it should be used. And I think there was a lot of people in these institutions that deserved it. They deserved compassion and they weren't given it. And that was in a society that was on the surface much more religious than we are today. It's interesting you mentioning kind of the Board of Guardians, and in the Madeley workhouse, even prior to its new building, they were notoriously bad. There was a number of people who were kind of elected on the Board of Guardians who were very notable in the area. So you've got kind of William Anstice, who was kind of an industrialist, a very heavily industrialist. You had the fourth Abram Darby the fourth, his brother Alfred, several other people as well, and various different people at different times, but none of them really seemed to have it as their priority. they didn't really take it seriously, except for a chap called Richard Darby. Now, Richard Darby is the other brother of Abram Darby the Fourth, and he is an absolutely fascinating chap outside of the area. He kind of took over the family's interests in Bristol. So he did a lot of work in Bristol in his early life, which made him very exposed to the slave trade and to kind of aspects of the slave trade in Britain, which completely converted him into kind of an ardent abolitionist. And he was very heavily involved with the abolition of the slave trade. And when he returned to the local community, when he returned to Madeley, he kind of distanced himself from the business, the Derby business in Coalbrookdale. He still was involved. He still kind of, made decisions, but he was known very much for being kind of a man of the people. And reading a little bit about him whilst I've been kind of researching for this episode, I really do believe that he had the poor's best interests at heart. I believe he was very passionate about helping, and I believe that he wanted the as much as the workhouse is a very cruel institution, I think he wanted to try and make the best of it as he could to help people. And it's interesting because when you look at several of kind of the reports, the minutes from the Guardians meetings, at times there was only actually one Guardian present, and that Guardian was Richard Darby. We've got a reference from the 27th of July 1837, and he says that he, in the actual notes, he says, being the only Guardian present and having waited for upwards and over an hour after the time of the meeting, I do adjourn the same to the Tuesday, the 3rd of August, signed Richard Darby. So often they couldn't even be bothered to turn up.
I
But
know, yeah.
in the midst of that, we had Richard, and Richard Darby was very concerned about the welfare of not just the people in kind of the workhouse, but also the people in the wider area. And I do believe he was a Quaker, quite an ardent Quaker, and I believe that he wanted to help. And you can still, if you ever are in the Coalbrookdale area, you can go to the Quaker burial ground, and that's where he's actually is buried. It's one of the most peaceful, it's one of my favourite places in the whole of Shropshire, the Quaker burial ground, and that's his little corner of Shropshire. But I think obviously he's a product of his time, but you can tell just through his involvement with kind of the abolition of the slave trade and other areas that this man actually cared in a world that didn't seem to.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. It's extraordinary. And I think the thing with the Board of Guardians, this kind of ad hoc, the poor law kind of brought this in, but these, like I say, and I mean, to be honest, you've done justice to as well, is really the for anybody kind of listening, the best image you can think of. And if you haven't seen it, maybe we've got some Gen Zers that haven't seen it because they're a bit young, but I'm sure there's not many that haven't, is to think of the, like I said at the start of the episode, is the film Oliver. That scene when they're looking through the window, you see that Board of Guardians. I would think that's not far off. I know some people are saying it's done for sort of dramatic effect, but look, let's be honest, that was done because there were scandals of, was it Halifax? There was somewhere where there was a Board of Guardians that were in a lot of trouble in terms of how the money was being used, and they were putting it towards these sort of luncheons and things, and just, yeah, honestly. And look, they went from kind of 18, the 1830s, 1835 to about 1930. So, I mean, look, that's very much still. There are people alive. So that is late in the day. That is kind of that's post First World War. It's 9 years before the Second World War. We're going late in the day for that to be a thing. And a lot of these people, their view of the poor that was that they thought this was if you will, hereditary. And there's a thing that the border, sorry, the cats just walked in. Well, I say the cat, one of them. The Board of Guardians said, you'll loathe this quite rightly. The care and training of children are matters which should receive the anxious attention of guardians. Pauperism is in the blood, and there is no more
Oof.
effectual means of checking its hereditary nature than by doing all in our power to bring up our pauper children in such a manner as to make them God-fearing, useful, and healthy members of society. Look, this I'm not going to go into the religious aspect, but yeah, this idea of God-fearing and look, if these people considered themselves God-fearing Christian, whatever else they were doing, they got a lot to answer to, I can tell you that. But some of the accounts saying here that the pale and this makes me sad, which is an understatement. The pale and unhealthy appearance of a number of children in the workhouse in a room called the infant nursery. These children appear to be from 2 to 3 years of age. This is hard. They are 23 in number and they all sleep in one room and they seldom or never go out of this room either for air or for exercise. These were accounts that were being taken. 104 girls slept in four or more to a bed, which is in a room that was 88 feet long, 16 and a half feet wide, and 7 feet high. And 89 of the 104 that were in that part were perhaps, it says, unsurprisingly, recently attacked with a fever. The girls and boys who are inmates of the workhouse shell for three of the working hours at least every day be instructed in reading, writing, arithmetic, and the principles of Christian religion, and such other instruction shall be imparted to them as may fit them for service and train them for the habits of usefulness, industry, and virtue. And there are rules where it says that no children under 12 should be punished by confinement in a dark room or during night. No corporal punishment should be inflicted on any male child except by the schoolmaster or master. The perversity of that. No corporal punishment should indeed be inflicted on any female child. No corporal punishment should be inflicted on any male child except with the rod or other instrument, such as may have the approved of by the guardians of the visiting committee. These guardians, the irony in the name that they're to protect, are the ones that can approve the instrument in which these children can be hit with. No corporal punishment should be inflicted on any male child until 2 hours should have elapsed from the commission of the offence for which such punishment is inflicted. So what, to let somebody calm down before they unleash them on a child? Whenever any male child is punished by corporal correction, the master and schoolmaster shall, if possible, be both present. So they're witnessing this. These figures of education, of protection, are watching. No male child should be punished by flogging whose age may be reasonably supposed to exceed 14 years. I think that says enough. In some cases, if I can as well, I wanted to read just briefly some of these that were just going to punishments, but. These are people from a Dorset workhouse. Benjamin Elliot, neglect of work on the 31st of May, 1842, dinner withheld and but bread for supper. Sarah Rowe, noisy and swearing, 19th of June, 1842, locked up for 24 hours on bread and water. John Aplin, disorderly in prayer time, 22nd of July, 1842, locked up for 24 hours on bread and water. George Minton, fighting in school, so he's a child. 26th of July, 1842, no cheese for a week. It goes on like this. So, breaking a window, sent to prison for 2 months. Deserted, got over a wall, James Park to be whipped. Isaac Hallett, breaking a window, sent to prison for 2 months. John Staple, refusing to work, committed to prison for 28 days. And let me say that prison was probably markedly worse than the workhouse, if, well. John Johnson refusing to work, cheese and tea stop for supper, breakfast stops altogether. So in some cases, some punishments were more severe than others. Elizabeth Super was making use of bad language in the bedroom, trying to excite other inmates to insubordination and refusing to work. And she was taken to the magistrate and committed to prison for 14 days of hard labour. Women that were seen to swear or cause problems were, often treated arguably even worse. And they were locked up in a cell which was called the refractory cell, which often was underground and was really quite a terrifying place. And that's why they're saying that children shouldn't be locked up in a room or a darkened room for 24 hours, because that's where these people were left, underground in a cell. I mean, I think a lot of what the thing is that you touched on, Richard, wasn't it, Darby, that he thought he was doing good. And look, I think there are people in this instances that genuinely, probably, absolutely were, and thought they were. And there are cases where workhouses were run comparatively well. And some were treated quite fairly. And I think you know, the benevolence of the person running the workhouse, you were sort of at their mercy, really. But a lot were the kind of the Mr. and Mrs. Bumble, you know, where really they were pretty cruel and pretty barbaric. But I think there were people out there like Richard that were set to help and things like that. So I think it's wrong to sort of, you know, implied that the entire of the 19th century was all based on cruelty. There were people that wanted change. There were people that were trying to make this institution work. There were a lot that were corrupt, a lot that didn't care, and a lot that had come up the ranks in this, and you know, that themselves maybe had worked through a workhouse. And you did find there's people that ran the wings and the wards and things often were people that had lived in the workhouse themselves. And so they had a very distorted view of normality, of looking after people. And as I mentioned earlier, you know, the physical and sexual abuse that goes with that, when you have, you know, when someone's institutionalized, when you take away normality, when people have been reared through the workhouse from infancy, you know, it's a jaded view of how you treat people. So a lot of these people, are they culpable? Some probably weren't because they'd never known any different. It's tricky, tricky.
Yeah, and I think that's the thing about it, isn't it? Is that human beings are complex. We are complex entities and we come in a myriad of different ways, and some of us are kinder than others, some of us have had harder experiences than others. And I think it's not to say that every single person that was involved in the running of the workhouse was a tyrant, but that these places could be the sh could show, I should say, the absolute worst of humanity and the absolute kind of the cruelty of humanity. So to move away from Madeley for a moment, up in Oswestry, the Mordor workhouse, not going to go into too much detail about it because I do want to stay in kind of the area, but Mordor was often seen as kind of atypical to the workhouse. It was seen as quite a positive, I don't like using the word positive, but it was quite a positive experience. And it was kind of marked by its kindness throughout its history. So I was reading an article about Mordor, and it was a chap whose parents actually run Sid Bailey, and his father and mother became master and matron in 1922. So right at the end, really, of its workhouse, its history as a workhouse. And he was writing a book about the event, and he said that in the 1920s, the building still had the atmosphere of the old Dickensian workhouse about it. Many of the inmates in the early years were varying degrees of disabled, and the regimented life of the workhouse suited them because they were not so happy, but some were not so happy to be there. He said that there was people of other backgrounds, and there was people who were educated and not educated. But he actually said that his parents encouraged him to play with the workhouse children and mix with the inmates. And the thing that impressed upon me from the very beginning by my father was to have respect for them, never laugh at them, never shout at them, never order them to do anything, treat them res with respect and as individuals. And that's the thing that's rubbed off on me on my whole life. So there were times when the workhouse, the people running the workhouse could be compassionate and kind. And I think for anyone who is interested in this kind of topic, I would recommend looking into Mordor. There's actually a brilliant kind of Time Team about Mordor Workhouse. I think it was Time Team. It was either Time Team or Digging for Britain. But there's a great deep dive kind of into its history, and it was known to be incredibly compassionate in a time that necessary wasn't necessarily so. And I love the idea of Sid's father telling him to never order them to do things or to never shout at them and to respect them, because he is going against the norm. And one can't help but kind of wonder what his father's experiences were to mold his views into that. But certainly, I think if we go back to Madeley, there was by around kind of the 1860s, it was clear that the building was not fit for purpose. It was awful, to be honest with you. The it's described by one commentator as a disgrace to the union. The workhouse was a disgrace to the union, and you started to get a number of people actually demanding that they knock down or they disuse the old workhouse at Brockholes and they build a new one. And the Guardians are very firm in the idea that they're not going to do it. There is, as pressure goes on, by about 1862, 1863, the pressure is really starting to build, and people are commenting on kind of how dire the building is. And I've got a quote from a report written by F.H. Hartshorne on the 26th of January, 1863. And this gives you a little bit of an insight into what the workhouse was like, the old building before it was the beaches, what we the beaches was built, and the new workhouse building was built. So the house is poor and dilapidated, and every part is now filled beyond its alleged means of accommodation, and it is quite unfit for the weak-minded or insane. Again, not my words. There are no means of exercise other than a small confined brickyard with high walls. There are no water closets in the house. The sole provision of this kind for all inmates is full wretch privies in the yards, and the only means of washing is out of galvanized buckets in the day room. The women's hospital is a small flagged room, destitute of every comfort, in which I found eight women huddled together on a bench. Throughout the house, there is hardly a chair or a decent piece of furniture. The dormitory above the hospital was dirty and ill ventilated, the atmosphere impure, and the bedding insufficient. Some sheets were torn to rags and all the beds unmade, although it was midday when I visited. The officers of the workhouse cannot be held worthy of blame as long as means so inadequate for decency or comfort are alone at their disposal. And this really report, obviously, as you can tell, it was very damning. And eventually it was agreed that a new workhouse would be built. And this took some time, but by 1871, the new building, which was the building that I worked in when it was a care home, was built on Beach Road opposite the Castle Green Cemetery in Madeley. And that was the new workhouse. It was meant to be a much more suitable building for people, and it was meant to kind of allow them a bit more comfort. It was the first to workhouse in Shropshire, certainly, but potentially in England, to adopt the pavilion block layout. So it's very kind
Okay.
of
Oh, that's
block.
interesting. Yeah.
And it was said to be a way in which they could try and redeem themselves after the disgrace that was the previous building.
Okay. Oh, that's fascinating. Because that's quite a big deal. Because, architecturally, that kind of formidable 18th century style that really actually is so familiar to almost all of us. And like I said earlier, Fordham's a really good example of that. You used to be able to drive up pretty close and have a look. You can't so much now because it's private. And I think they probably got a lot of people doing exactly what I did. So they sort of kind of have gates and cameras and they've been like, no, go away. But you can see it from the road, and it's not great in terms of it has a fearsome image. It's quite scary, and very tragic. And that's the 18th century idea. But these changes that they had, and the hexagonal, different kind of formats that they had, and they had nightingale wings and things, which are sort of long wings, but the pavilion was kind of going into that. That was considered like a welfare change, wasn't it? Basically, and it gave like room for sort of exercise yards and the benefits of all that kind of thing as well. And look, what is interesting with these workhouses is, and sometimes it's not always known, but like asylums, and again, not my choice of word, but what they were known as, were very much self-contained. So they had often cases their own farms and things like this. And in some cases, produce their own electricity, even in the later 19th century. They also had big water towers. Again, Fordham has one. You can see it from the road. And tragically, and really, really abhorrently as well, they buried the dead, often not in graveyards. As we know, in the north part of Churchill, sometimes a reserve for people who are unmarried, victims of suicide. But I say that because I loathe the phrase "committed suicide." It's not a crime. And then sometimes people from the poor, or people that couldn't afford headstones, things like that. There's lots of smaller parish churches and things that have graves from people that couldn't afford gravestones. More often than not, the workhouses, they buried their dead on site. There was controversy over the year, controversy, sorry, where they tried to move people over the years and things like this, but that's a different subject, really. But they were buried on site. And it is for those that are looking to track their ancestors, and I have ancestors that were at the workhouse. We have very solid evidence for that. It's difficult to track, and you probably, likely, sadly, will never find their graves. And so they are not all but forgotten, but there is no place for someone to go to, which I think, other than a sort of monolithic symbol of the past. But also, for those, whether you're religious or not, it does seem to have a really rather tragic anonymity to it, that these people were sort of largely forgotten or faceless in life, and so in death too, which just seems a tragedy, having been treated cruelly in life as well. I think the workhouse, it has a very controversial past. And one, when you look at these things, and you can look at the buildings, which in some strange way are really sort of architecturally impressive, frankly. They're terrifying, but they are, and they add details. They add beautiful details to these buildings that now look incredible. But when you know their past, and somehow that makes it even more tragic. And when you know that these people just trying to get into the workhouse or leaving the workhouse, the fact that that in itself was a challenge, and that actually for many people who went to the workhouse, they never left. And I think the stigma that remains, that the fact that Bishop's Castle Hospital, for example, there were older people that, when told they were going to the hospital, going to Bishop's Castle, which was a sort of more of a cottage hospital after the NHS, said, "Don't send me to the workhouse," because they still thought of it as a workhouse. And my granny, who's still alive, she's in well into her 80s, and she remembers people talking about the workhouse. She didn't know about it as such, but she said she remembers people talking about it, and it was still something people feared, and it still is now. And this in itself is controversial. When you're researching these things, you can't really find anything that's still within somebody's lifetime in terms of names and things like that. They still protect people's identity that either went to the workhouse or had something to do with the workhouse. It's still, especially if someone could still be living, that in itself is controversial. And I think you need to remind yourself, things like gruel that we're all familiar with, people were sustained off this diet. And I know, look, in some cases people were given bread, cheese, things like this, but the recipe for gruel is 2 ounces of oatmeal or porridge, oats, 1 pint of water, half an ounce of optional, we hasten to add, treacle, and a pinch of salt. It was suggested that this was brought to the boil and simmered for 20 minutes and served warm. And it should be served quickly, because it shouldn't be reheated, and because it spoils. But actually, the reality of this is that large volumes required breakfast gruel, or some people were sustained almost solely off gruel. And they've been often prepared the day before. There is nothing in it, no nutritional value. And so these things that come to us now as, sort of not, I don't know what's the idea, almost caricatures of themselves. The idea of Oliver Twist in his outfit, it's kind of, it's an outfit now, even though it's something they wore through neglect. These are all things that are in our psyche. And whether it's the kind of the tooting tragedy that Charles Dickens wrote about in 1849, the cholera pandemic that swept through, the workhouse there, 150 children died from cholera in that year. I mean, all these things are extraordinary. And now we think of the workhouse, and you almost do a Dick Van Dyke kind of accent in some cases, but actually the reality of it, and I would encourage people to look into it, and I would encourage people to research, and for their ancestors that went there, to get rid of that taboo, to talk about it, to normalize it, the subject, and to better educate ourselves on the plight of people then. And I think only if we start to do that and we start to educate ourselves in the past and attitudes, then can we also start to educate ourselves about the present and the future and get rid of stigmas to do with, you know, to do with poverty, to do with how we treat people, to do with care in the community. Because after the NHS came in, which still, you know, today just is put through so many hoops and is so exhausted, and the resources that, you know, that get exhausted, I think now more than ever we need to be aware and learn our lessons from the past and look at how we treat one another, and the terms that we use, pejorative, whatever, you know, these terms are now so abhorrent to us, imbecile, idiot, things like that. There are still words used today that history will frown on, quite rightly.
Yeah.
And look about how we talked about our you know, our fellow man. And look, I, for my part, I'm going to end here, and then you can kind of see us out, Amy. But, you know, the quote I often think of is from Oliver Twist: Mr. and Mrs. Bumble, deprived of their situations, were gradually reduced to great indigence and misery, and finally became paupers in that very same workhouse in which they had lauded it over others. They ended there, which some might say quite right. The twist of that was that Nancy, Oliver, and many others were born into a life they had no choice over. The Bumbles made their path and they chose to treat people abhorrently. And just as with Scrooge having his warning from the ghosts of Christmas past and present and yet to come, he learned his lesson, the Bumbles, too late, and were in a situation of their own making. Now, I don't really go in for an eye for an eye or anything like that, but I think this idea of complacency, nobody knows what's waiting around the corner. I think we need to treat people decently. We need to understand the complexities of people's lives and things like that. And I think historically, presently, and for the future, destigmatize things like poverty. And I think educate ourselves, offer help, offer compassion. These people need our compassion, not our pity. And people should be enabled and given opportunity. I think then there's nothing we could have done about it now. In the past, it's been tragically, but now and the future we can. And I think looking at things like this is a stepping stone into the decency that we should show each other.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. And I think I want to briefly finish on something that you touched on with the idea of burials.
Yeah,
I want to touch on kind of how burials were seen in Madeley, and particularly pauper burials and inmate burials. As you said, you've got family that were in the workhouse.
Mm-hmm.
I have an awful lot of my family that have pauper burials, so I can go and visit the graveyard they're in, but there's no tangible evidence of them. I come from a very long line of pauper burials. It's only my great grandparents that actually have kind of headstones. Mm-hmm. So this, I think, the way in which pauper burials were treated in Madeley for much of its history, it really does hit hard. And I think an inmate of a workhouse has to contend with so many indignities. But perhaps the worst, in my opinion, is the pauper burial. And the Madeley guardians, they were so concerned with the increasing cost of pauper burials that they started really trying to focus on it from about the late 1830s. And we have a minute from the 15th of June, 1838. And it says, a complaint has been made by the irregularity of our contractor for coffins in not seeing to the burials of paupers, but permitting their friend or relatives to bury them. It is ordered that in our next contract, there be inserted a proviso that in case the deceased paupers are not taken to the burial ground in the parish hearse or in any case, ornaments are put on their coffins, this board will not pay expenses attending such a funeral. So to reduce the cost even further, they ordered that the corpse should be given a very, very basic coffin, and that they should be borne to the burial ground by the actual inmates. It's just, you can't. So at first there was the idea that yes, as long as it's the parish hearse, they will put the money forward, but it goes even further and they say that actually, no, we're not we're not paying for it. The coffin won't be adorned, the grave won't be adorned, and you know, the fellow inmates can carry that person to the burial ground. And as you said, quite often it was within the grounds of the workhouse. Certainly in the earlier days of the Madeley workhouse, it was within the grounds. And you just, I just can't imagine the indignity of that. And also what must have been going through the minds of the people that were carrying those coffins that were, you know, they might not have liked the person, they might have had a connection with the person, but it must have been so hard to carry that body to the burial ground and to lay it to rest with no service or no decency. And I think I agree with your sentiment about the destigmatizing. I think we need to be proud of our ancestors. If this is our ancestor story, we need to be proud of the fact that they've endured and that their struggle there, and that's not just people within the workhouse, but that is people who have been working class, agrarian class, those kind of people that have worked hard and existed. We need to be proud of them because they are the reason we are here. And I think once we start to destigmatize our own stories, and if it's not your ancestors, but other people's stories, we can work to ensuring that things like this don't happen again, and also that the poor aren't treated this way again. And I think that's why histories like this are important, because it goes beyond, you know, it goes beyond the history. It's the legacy of these stories. As you said, when you're reading about kind of Madeley, there was always the threat of the workhouse, even after the workhouse had shut down. For example, it's quite prevalent in Madeley, unmarried mothers. There was the threat of ending up in some form of institution like the workhouse, even though those institutions that kept women in those kind of conditions didn't exist anymore. We need to treat people, I think, with empathy. And I think we need to treat people like human beings. And the workhouse can symbolize the very, very worst of human experience. But I think we can use that to then ensure that things like this don't happen again.
I think you articulate that. You articulate it perfectly, because, you know, this, when you've got the peace super of time and these sort of rather scary buildings and Dickensian images, and, you know, it's all too easy to assume that that is a problem that no longer exists, but it simply isn't true. And in a cost of living crisis, you know, God, these things are very, very apparent to us. And we're in a society where, you know, some people can afford to own 2-3 homes and others are going to food banks. The divide is hard. And, you know, this idea that you had the bread riots, the Rebecca riots, all these things that went on politically that kind of saw about the kind of not the necessity, well, the necessity for something to be done, but the workhouses perhaps weren't maybe the best option, but that created a mass poverty. And you mentioned the agrarian society, so, you know, the Industrial Revolution, most people moving to the cities and things. These are all things that happen, and these are all things, you know, when you had the 70s, the 80s, factories closing, mining ending, you know, there's forever this idea of people closing factories, ending jobs. You know, those people don't simply go away, you know, and I think we can't really sort of pretend that these things don't happen, and that, you know, these are terms that we don't need to worry about, because we ourselves are, you know, fortunate enough to be in a position of, you know, of being in our own homes and things like this. You know, I think with the workhouse, for those that are interested, I think there's a lot can be done through your local archives and things like that. Great things on various websites. The workhouse website is fantastic. Peter Higginbotham, I was going to say Higginbotham, sorry, Peter. Peter Higginbotham has done a lot for raising awareness and things like that. And he gives a fairly, you know, he's very honest about workhouses, but he also sees some of the good that they did as well. So he's really interesting. There's lots of records, infirmary records, things like this, things that you can look up, particularly for those that are outside of somebody's living, you know, someone's life. So older records, yeah. And again, it's going to be a few more years before there's some that we can find in more recent times. But I really do encourage that people look into it. I think it's a fascinating, deeply tragic subject, and one that we just, I suppose, constantly need to remind ourselves that these people were real. The legacy is in the buildings. Again, the irony that some of those are wealthy flats, probably suitably Victorian, to be honest. So there we go. But look, we're back in a couple of weeks with another episode, which we're very excited, and we'll try and keep it a little bit more cheerful, hopefully. But I think tonight has been a difficult episode, but one that we were both very keen to do, and we felt that was really important. So thank you so much for listening. Thank you so much, Amy, for broaching that in the way that you did. And we hope to speak to you all soon, and hope you enjoy this episode as much as you can.
Yes, and thank you so much for listening, and I think for continuing to support us. We are so proud of what we've achieved in the short time that we've been doing this, but also how you've responded to us. It's amazing to be able to convey our passion for a variety of different subjects and have people listen. So we are so grateful for your continued support, and all we can say is that there's more to come and there's some very exciting times ahead.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, we wouldn't be able to kind of do all this if you guys weren't supporting us in the way that you do. It's incredible. We're so, so grateful. So thank you so, so much. We'll see you in a couple of weeks. Bye bye bye.
Bye. Bye.
Bye bye.